Want to keep your personal number private but still stay connected? With Line 2, you can get a second phone line right on your device with a super simple app and no need for another phone. Whether it's for online shopping, dating, or shielding your main number from spam, Line 2 is an easy way to manage it all. Ready for peace of mind without breaking the bank? Call, text, block, and more for only $9.99. Get started with line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in any app store today. Line 2, your second line simplified.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff.
Ahoy, friends. Thank you for tuning into Truth and Justice. You are listening to the Friday follow-up for Season 5, Episode 46. This is a blast from the past, and we had an update on the West Memphis 3 case with a lovely discussion with Damian Eccles, Lori Davis, and Jillian Pensavalle. But before we get into that, I'm joined by Bob and Janet today. And do we have any housekeeping?
I don't think so. Nothing super new going up. We did, Eric and I, on Friday, had a Zoom meeting with the legal team for our Season 17 case. We're moving along. it was a good meeting. It was one of those where I almost thought the rug was going to get yanked out because there's been some developments.
Oof. Oh,
and I thought the next sentence was going to be, so never mind. And then I was going to be no problem and then have a fit because we've spent so many months working on the case. But that's not the case. They're just, we had to get some documents signed. I just got those back today. I'm still hoping that we can push through to start, you know, the like second week of June. We'll start with a new season. But should be soon. Like things look like they're coming along soon. There's a lot of moving parts on this one. Yeah. Other than that, just a quick reminder that we will all be off from, I'll be gone, whatever the dates are, June 9th, whatever. Note to episode that week. You'll know when you tune in on Sunday. There's no episode.
Fair enough.
That one time when you tune in and there's no episode, that's the one.
Got it.
Well, I know we're a couple weeks out, but I'm very excited about this new case just based on what I can see when I come in here in the office.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be a good case.
The whiteboards and the corkboards.
Yes. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting one, complex one. And hats off to Erica. She's done such a really, really good job of sorting through all that and making it so I can navigate what's mm-hmm. going on because there's so much. I don't want to give any more away, but there's just a lot happening in this
yeah.
case. And with that, I guess we'll get right into this. This was cool. I enjoyed it. I haven't had a chance to talk to Damian for a little while. And so it was nice, you know, even before we started rolling, just being able to catch up a little bit. And him and Lori both, it was great to see both of them. And I thought it was a great conversation. I already have seen, we've been getting a lot of listeners that have been like, you know, tweeting at me or sharing or commenting on posts that they are, you know, that they've been reaching out to Ms. Haygood, and hopefully that'll get things rolling again. What'd you guys think?
I thought it was great. I mean, it's great to hear from everybody. Obviously, you would wish that the circumstances would be a little different. It would be lovely mm-hmm. if this was an opportunity for you all to connect about the success. I hope that that's forthcoming. I felt like everybody in the conversation was still like very optimistic, so that was encouraging. And I appreciated the way you guys approached kind of, you know, we always talk about it, like handle with care, this kind of crowd engagement. And what when you ask something of people to really be clear about what it is that you need and what's going to help the case, what's going to help the guys, and not approach it from a way that's going to be detrimental. So overall, it was a really great episode. Again, I just hope that the next follow up is one of like, okay, something good has happened for real this time. We're
getting the testing done.
Yeah,
I've seen some great letters that, you know, some people have like sent me screenshots of like what they sent. You know,
nice.
I've just seen some great ones that have just been like, "Hey, we really appreciate what you've done on the work you've done on the case. I'm just writing because you know we're all you know very excited to see justice finally served, and we're just hoping you know would it be possible? Could you just give us an update? There's just so many of us out here that care so deeply about this case, and we just want to let you know that we're still here." Watching and waiting, and we would just love to see some kind of an update so we know what's going on. you know, things like that. I hope, you know, I don't know Sonya Haygood, but I'm hoping that those are well received.
Well, and it was really nice to hear the things that we don't know that's going on. A little bit that Lori filled us in on.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it's maddening that it's taking this long, the fact that there's been a little bit of dialogue there. I don't understand exactly what's going on with the having to edit the petition.
Questions about that too, yeah.
But I'm happy that there has been dialogue, that it's not just been totally shut out.
Yeah.
So that's at least promising.
Yeah. It's just, I think the only concern is just that there hasn't been much communication, you know, because like, you know, I touch base with Damian quite a bit about it. And, you know, and Damian has just had the rug yanked out from underneath him so many times that he's always just like, it's just, they're just not going to do it. I feel like they're doing it to us again. They get us right there. But, you know, then he says like everything they're saying is it's happening. But then we're like, it's been 2 months. Like, what are we waiting for here? And like, nobody seems to know that other than, you know, that little bit that they're, you know, but then they finally will get a response. Like, still planning on doing the testing, just need to do some editing.
Hmm.
So yeah, hopefully that comes forward. And for me, like, it was a really big deal. It meant a lot to me that Damian was able to, you know, trusted us enough to come on the show. Cause I mean, he just doesn't want to do it. It's so traumatic for him to do anything like this. Mm-hmm. And I see why, like, you know, cause we posted the Jillian and Patrick posted the episode on their feed too, to get it on more ears. And then I went ahead and posted the video. So any of you guys that haven't seen it on our YouTube channel, I went ahead and posted the video version of it too yesterday.
Oh, nice.
To put that out. And of course, that's all like, you know, just public commenting on it. And I just see some, there's so many great, wonderful, supportive comments on there. But then there's also like, it's so disheartening to see the trolls come out of the woodwork and like the things they say about or to Damian or and it's just like, I see why he just doesn't want to do it. Like, he knows, imagine knowing every time that you open your mouth to speak about justice, you know, just wanting the truth to come out about something, knowing 100% that you're going to get bombarded with people calling you names and, you know, just everything that he deals with every day. So it meant a lot to me that he was, you know, willing to do that because it's so important to him. And that part of that conversation was that it's not just for him. He's you know, in some of our more candid conversations, he's just like people forget that this is about these three little boys too. Like, he's like, I know, Damon's like, I know we didn't have anything to do with this.
Yeah.
Like, whoever killed them is still out there. We just need to find out who did it. Yeah. And it was cool too to hear him, you know, talk, you know, when I asked him like, what is it, you think life like, because, you know, those negative comments are all, oh, he's just trying to grift money and do like, he hasn't asked for a dime from anyone through any of this process. And you know, you didn't hear in his what I think life is going to look like that, oh, well, I want to sue and get $1 million and do da da whatever. He's just like, I just want to be able to put this behind me and move on with my life. That's all I want.
Right.
That's all he wants.
Right. Well, I thought, you know, when he was talking about like, I don't know, I think a lot of us can relate on some small level. Of course, everyone walks a very different path. And what happened to him was extraordinary. We all wish that it weren't. It was even more extraordinary than it is, since we know what we know about wrongful convictions. Mm-hmm. But just hearing him kind of go like, I don't let myself go there and think too much about what I can't do. But then when he was talking about wishing that, you know, he could leave the country and it just, you know, that moment, like, I appreciate that he shared that. It definitely was also a kind of a gut punch, like, yeah.
Yeah,
like,
I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
I don't know why. I guess I knew it if I thought about it, but I didn't realize that he was not able to leave the country.
Yeah,
I mean, with that conviction on his record.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that
is it.
Yeah. Okay.
And I don't know. Is it that he's not allowed to leave or is it that he's not allowed to enter those countries?
I'm not sure.
Because it could be just the countries that he's trying to.
Yeah, it might be.
And I don't know. I'm just spitballing.
Because where did he say he wanted to go to Japan?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that he couldn't get one to Japan with the felony on his record.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, pretty heartwarming. I know I don't want to go on for too long because I know we've got several listener questions that we need to get through. We'll do our best to answer them. I'm sure a lot of them are in the legal purview.
Well, this one is an easy one. Kelly says, it was great to hear them. I followed this case since 2000, 2001, then got deep into it after Devil's Knot, the book. My question is, when did Bob, Janet, and Zach start following the case?
Out of the three of us, I've probably been around the case the longest.
Mm-hmm.
I started following the case around 2002, 2003, kind of when I stumbled across it. Shortly after the second Paradise Lost documentary was released, and I had gone back and watched both of those, what really tied me to it was the fact that I was about the age of Damien and Jesse and Jason. And it really kind of wrapped my head around that. And then the idea that these, the three boys that were murdered were my age. They're born in 1984.
Mm-hmm.
And I was born in 1984. So even, I mean, I didn't really necessarily think about it in 2002, but as I think about it today, I think about that a lot, actually.
Yeah.
But I, so I've been around the case following it with the Paradise Lost series, the Devil's Knot book, since early 2000s as well.
Yeah. And it's actually, this case is how Zach and I got to be friends, really.
Yes.
When I started getting ready, it was like 2017 when I started working on covering the case for the podcast, gone to Zach's shop to get a tattoo, and we got to talk, and we had a little, can I have your phone number moment
at the tattoo?
Yeah. But yeah, it was one of those cases for me where I was working, as I've talked about many times on the show, I've never really been into much true crime. So, you know, I wasn't in those circles studying this stuff. So I started working on Adnan's case. That's how this podcast started. And then other wrongful convictions. And what always came up, I remember Rick Robbia telling me, he's like, oh, I watched the West of Memphis documentary. And that's what, you know, made me think that, you know, a journalist could bring shed some light on Adnan's case. And, you know, everybody would always bring up the West Memphis 3 case. And I always felt like, I'm like, I don't even know anything about that. And that was, you know, I've told the story before, but in 2017, I thought, I don't know, I had a weekend at home and I'm like, you know, I'm going to watch these documentaries and just, you know, see what everybody's talking about with this case. And I watched them and I went through the same emotions everybody else went through and they watched it. And then what got me was, I still remember Mike and I were going to, we might've been going to Houston to work on Sandy Melgar's case, but we were traveling somewhere. And I was telling him about the West Memphis 3 case, like it's, you know, this documentary is crazy. And you know, how they, in the first one, they, you know, I think it's part two, they convince you that John Mark Byers did it. And then three, it's, you know, things keep flip flopping around. And I went to tell him about the victims and what happened. And I realized after spending a weekend watching four documentaries about the case, I had no idea what those boys' names were. Mm-hmm. Not that they never said them, I'm not saying, but it was just like, they weren't the focus. And I was like, and I was kind of ashamed of myself. I'm like, how did I not, like, me doing what I do, how did I not pay enough attention that I even know what their names are? And then I started searching, you know, researching it more and more and more, and realized it's like, they've never been the focus of any of this work. The focus has always been on Damien, Jason, and Jesse. And that's kind of where the term, in that conversation with Mike, is where we came up with the forgotten West Memphis 3.
Sure.
It was like there's two West Memphis 3s, and one of them was completely forgotten about once Damien, Jason, and Jesse got out of prison. And what I had learned by that point, you know, I had spent, you know, a few years working a lot with Jim Clemente, who's been, you know, mentoring me about investigative practices and things like that. I'm like, you always start with victimology. You always, you know, the investigation has to be focused around the victims. And so I wonder if we can go back to the beginning and start over and just do a new investigation from that perspective, not to try to clear their names, but to try to solve this murder,
right,
where we can get with it. So that's...
Well, and it's, and I don't mean to bogart this, but it's also curious to me to wonder how much help and how much hurt those documentaries caused. Obviously, it kept it in the forefront and it saved Damien and it saves Damien's life, these mm-hmm. documentaries.
Yeah.
But also it puts so much false narrative out there,
right,
that everybody believes that. You know, at one point it was John Mark Byers.
Right.
At another point it was David Jacoby and Terry Hobbs, and it just kept building and building. I mean, with that being said, genuinely probably saved Damien's life because it kept it in the news.
No probably about it. Like 100% it did. And he would tell you, like Joe Berlinger and them and Amy Berg with West of Memphis and even Mara Leverett, like all the work that was done on it absolutely did. But then, you know, all the false narratives, I remember watching, because then I watched The Devil's Knot. I think I had already seen it because I was watching. I'm like, I've seen this movie. I saw The Devil's Knot, the movie that was an adaptation.
It was like Reese Witherspoon.
Yeah, I never watched
Mara's,
that.
Yeah, it was an adaptation of Mara's book. And like the opening scene, they're riding off into the woods. And the way they shot like the scenes of the crime scene and everything, I had pictured this whole like big, you know, big, huge, you know, deep, dark forest that the boys were in. And I remember when Mike and Shane Yoder, our music guy, went, because he's from Tennessee, he like went and we all met there and we went to the crime scene to start, you know, investigating. And I was like, what? First of all, the woods were gone. But then I just looked at the area. Then once I looked at I'm like, it was a patch of woods the size of a football field. Like it was completely different, you know, than what I thought it was.
Yeah.
When did you first discover the case, Janet?
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
So I saw the first Paradise Lost. I had a lot of like documentary film nerds friends when I was in college. And
back in the 1900s?
Back in the 1900s. And so, it's not fair for me to say I followed it avidly since then. Like, I definitely watched everything as it rolled out in real time, but I wasn't like, you know, I was their age.
Yeah.
And I was like a punk. I was like a goth. I had a lot of friends who got in a lot of trouble for wearing, you know, pentagrams and eyeliner and trenches and trench coats. Like, every one of my friends for a period of time looked like Damien.
Yeah.
And so, and we, like, you know, our friends were huge Pearl Jam fans, and Eddie Vedder started advocating pretty early on for the guys. And so that was definitely, I mean, it was terrifying because I was living that life, the same thing that Eddie Vedder and like Henry Rollins and advocates like that, that were kind of heroes to me when I was a teenager, were, you know, we were like, yeah, like, it doesn't, this feels like it's about something that we all felt. Like, I still get tense when I walk past a police car and I look like a soccer mom. But that kid in you that's like used to getting in trouble, or that's used to being judged for the way you look, for whatever thing you're going through or whatever your beliefs are that you're expressing on the outside, if it's outside of the norm or if it's considered, you know, and this is for me in Tucson, Arizona, which is a very liberal city, but it's still Arizona. So all of that like really resonated for me and was terrifying and like really upsetting. So I think in some ways that was the first thing that got me interested in, like, yeah, true crime and wrongful convictions in general. Before, you know, I wouldn't have been like a serial killer. I wasn't interested in that kind of thing. I was interested in this sort of stuff.
Yeah. So we've all been, I think I was the last to come around.
Yeah. I did not know Janet was that. Janet's further along than I am. I didn't realize that. Mm-hmm.
Well, again, like, well, I
sorry
I wish
for
I
saying
could say that.
That
I was chasing and following information. It was more just like, whenever there was be something else that would be released, of course, I'd be like, oh, got to see that. But yeah, it's but you're right. The misinformation, that's a real thing. I mean, I definitely remember like turning to people and saying, well, you know, this one of the stepfathers did it. His name is John Mark Byers. Like, you know, when you're 19 or whatever, you don't know.
Yeah, that was.
Yeah.
And look how crazy he's
You don't
been.
Know.
Look
yeah. So it's definitely tricky. Tracy says, this is just a Tracy, a comment that I think we've sort of been saying in one way or another, but I thought it was kind of the right way to describe it in a different way that would still resonate for people, which is, anyone else been feeling that for the longest time? In this case, the state is Lucy with the football and we're all Charlie Brown. That is a very good way of putting it. Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Tracy,
we're
yes.
hoping in this case that it's not Lucy, that they just called a timeout to ice the kicker for a minute.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. And that takes us to Veronica and Ryan kind of saying what you were saying, Zach, which is like, what do we know what it means that editing has to take place, changing the date? And this is just the concern, I think, for people is, well, wait a minute. If everything was ready to go and then it was just about one person being ill, why wasn't everything still ready to go? Like, what changed? What still needs to be tinkered with?
That's what I wish we knew the answer to that, and we just don't. Yeah, that and actually that was, you know, I didn't know until I think the day we were recording that they had gotten some feedback that said they're editing, you know, that they're editing the order. But yeah, I don't know what, I mean, there have been, I know that for over the last, you know, since what, September, October, when we found out that like this is happening, there have been several renditions of the order. You know, there was, you know, with the addition of Jason and his team coming in into the process, you know, and so there's, you know, discussions about labs, what's being tested, what's not going to be tested. you know, because it, you know, it started with a very small scope because we knew we were going to fight for it. Mm-hmm. And it was like, the thing we think we're the most confident in is the bindings. Mm-hmm. And, but once we got a prosecutor that's like, you know, was, you know, is like on our side and is like, let's make this happen. Then it's like, well, then if we got a chance, let's take that, as they say, shoot your shot and let's get it. So I know there's been a lot of different renditions. So it could be something like that. I don't know, but that's kind of part of the frustration is it's like, you know, we hear, you know, it's being edited, but what?
Right.
Is being edited, yeah. You know?
Well, Sarah, one of our listeners, wanted to kind of help at least contribute possibly, you know, she knows it's a different situation, but if it's helpful at all, she said, from the perspective of someone who works in local government, sometimes the wheels can turn slowly for completely dull and bureaucratic reasons. For example, yeah. It took me over a year to get revisions to proclamation guidelines in front of our local council. I needed input from several people. Edits had to be made based on that, and they had more pressing issues to consider, etc. This was a one-page document that just formalized things and changed very little. It's not the same, obviously, and I don't know what's happening here, but part of me is hopeful that this is the situation, in which case a lot of people asking for updates can demonstrate to all the powers be that this is something that needs to be a priority. You got to be a squeaky wheel sometimes. My concern is that someone behind the scenes is getting in the way and creating the bureaucracy to slow this down. I don't know enough about how a prosecutor's office operates to know who that would be and what that would look like, though. But Sarah, thanks for reminding us of that, you know. And you've seen very well firsthand as well, Bob, how slow the wheels of progress can move. And sometimes it is for nefarious reasons, and sometimes it's just like the machine, right?
Oh, perfect. A perfect example. I mean, it's not the same, but along the same lines as I'm dealing with it. I don't know if I've mentioned on this show, but on the pregame, we've talked about it. I had sold my cabin and property that I have up in northern Michigan, and I'm buying another property further south that has to be subdivided off of a bigger plot. That's been months, and I just keep communicating with the seller, and what he's dealing with is getting the township government to meet and have on the agenda to approve the survey so that we can close. Like, it's been months and we're still like, when are we going to close? And we're just still waiting, and it's just one of those, like, there's nothing going on. Like, they're telling him, oh yeah, it's going to be fine, but it's just, you know, those small government offices like that sometimes take time. So that's always a possibility. But that's, I kind of, part of what, like, if you're still calling, and don't stop, like, you know, what we don't want is for them to have 2 days of people, like, calling, texting, like, we need to, like, continue on, again, being very kind about it. But I think that's one of the things is, like, if we could just get some communication, if we could be like, everything's fine, you know, if we heard from Sonia Haygood, everything's fine, we're moving forward, we're just waiting on this thing to get notarized, then we can, you know, or something, you know, it's like everybody can take a breath. But it's like, it's because of it, and I feel bad for Ms. Haygood too, a little bit, because I think she's dealing with the 32 years
sure
of Lucy pulling the football away.
Yeah.
Right. So like she hasn't done anything wrong, but we've become so accustomed to over these decades, like people just intentionally stonewalling, blocking the truth from coming out, doing anything they can, that it's just like, I think we're always in that defensive posture where it's like, oh, things aren't going the way they're supposed to be. They're probably trying to screw us over again.
Right.
Yeah. But to be clear, like, there's no indication that we have that that's what's happening. But I think that she's probably, you know, that's what's happening now as far as how we're all feeling is the result of that.
Well, and it kind of goes back to what you were saying, Zach, and if we talked about this and I was just reading something, like if I was reading the comments and I missed this part, but in your reference to, yeah, like the misinformation and stuff that comes out of that kind of national and international attention, it's also that thing that happens, like we've seen with people like Adnan, where the more publicity something gets from outside of its own community, and I think that's why, you know, we hear Jillian in your episode saying it really matters if you live in Arkansas. It especially matters. Do it no matter where you are. But is that you see this response from local law enforcement or from local criminal justice where that's like, oh, these people think they can just come in here and question our jobs and make us look stupid. And it does at this point, it doesn't even matter what's true. It's like, just F you, everyone from the outside. They sort of close ranks and it feels like it's a violent reaction to the attention, even though that same attention is what is keeping it alive and getting someone out of prison. Right, Zach?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, definitely we do have people who weighed in and say, you know, that feeling again of the football being taken away. Nancy says it feels so much like the police care a lot more about covering their mistakes than actually finding the killers. Are they the ones with physical custody of the evidence, even if the prosecutor has legal custody? I worry the box may have been misplaced.
Hopefully, I mean, that would be a pretty disastrous move, I think. So, yeah, it was when they located the evidence after Keith Cressman told us that the evidence was gone and had been destroyed and there was the lawsuit and all that. And then they found it, air quotes, found it. Mm-hmm. It was located in the evidence room at the police department. They're the ones that have it. And I believe that's still physically where it's at. But for it to like disappear now would be like this has been actively being litigated since it was seen and photographed by the defense. So like for them to like claim now, like, oh, we lost it. Like, no, I don't suspect that would even be on anybody's mind. I've also seen, I don't know, did somebody in there ask a question I thought I saw about concerns about tampering with the evidence?
That's the next question from Jennifer. Yeah.
Yeah. So Jennifer had asked like, you know, are we worried about, you know, they have Damien and Jason and Jesse's DNA that things can be tampered with? I mean, all we can do is hope that that's not, you know, that they wouldn't do that someone have some shred of conscience. I don't personally, I'm not concerned about that. I don't think, you know, we're not dealing with Gary Gitchell anymore. You know, there's so many generations that have come and gone out of that department since then. I just don't think that there's somebody in that department now that is willing to risk their career and reputation and perhaps their freedom to try to frame somebody to what end. Like, remember, they're out on an Alford plea.
Mm-hmm.
There's zero risk of them going back to prison. Like, if they were to test this DNA and Damien Knuckles' DNA was all over everything, then it would, you know, cause the public to be like, F you, Damien. But that's the consequence of it, right? Because they've already pled guilty and served their sentence. That's how the Alford plea works. So, like, to what end is somebody going to take that risk just so they can be like, ha-ha, gotcha? And also so that we don't find... And also, even if they did that, like, say they were to, you know, plant some of Damien's DNA on some of this evidence, it's still not going to get rid of the other DNA that's there.
Point.
You know what I mean? So they would test it and be like, well, Damien's DNA is there, but so is this serial killer's DNA. That's right. Weird.
Well, and it seems like with the age of the evidence too, that it would be noticeable that
it would
been
be
tampered with.
We learned about that gosh, which case was that we worked on where they talked about the degradation of the DNA?
You would expect to see a certain degradation.
It was in the Pinion Pines case.
Right.
On the business card where, yeah, the expert said that you can tell in the electropherogram that by the degradation of this DNA is what you would expect if it has been like out and exposed to the elements for over a year in that case, when they're talking about like Christian's DNA on that business card. So, yeah, so I don't know a whole lot about it, but based on that, I would assume that if, you know, they took something out of a vial of blood that had Damien's DNA and put it on there, one, the sheer volume of DNA that would create that shouldn't be there in these circumstances. And it would, you know, not show, you know, 32 years of degradation of being exposed to. Even though it's, you know, kept in a bag in an evidence room, it's still being exposed to some environmental issues as opposed to like a vial of blood somewhere or something like that. So, yeah, obviously it's always a concern, particularly in this case, but it's not something I have a big concern about.
Yeah. And just to reiterate, like, we all totally understand anyone being concerned about that. Again, it is, if ever there's a case to be worried about just the worst possible case scenario, there has not been a whole lot of acts of trustworthiness that have happened up to this point. But I agree that the hope would be that there's a pretty distinct difference between obfuscation that is passive and obfuscation that is active. Like, it's easy to say you lost something. It's a lot different to say, I don't know anything about DNA. I'm just like a sheriff or whatever, but I'm going to go ahead and like pull something out of a bag and put it into a different, like, that feels like, woof. Okay, buddy.
It's like I said, it's a huge risk.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I just and keep in mind, like, when I've been there working on the case, like, I've met several West Memphis police officers and even have talked to them about like what I was doing. And they were, and Zach, you remember when we were down there, the one officer, when the judge was not letting us go inside in that sweltering heat, you know, that one police officer that was like charged with doing that, like brought us over water and was like, he was apologizing and was like, you know, if somebody needs to get in my car or something, he's like, I'm sorry. Like, these are, I just don't want to ever cast with that broad of a brush to be like, oh, you're a West Memphis cop, so you're crooked. That's not the case.
Yeah.
I remember him saying he didn't know why they were doing that even.
Yeah, he didn't even know anything about the case. He was like, I don't understand why they're doing this. I've never seen them do anything like that. And he was a veteran. Like, he was like a lieutenant.
Yeah.
And we're like, well, it's because it's this case. Mm-hmm. And he was just like, okay.
Hmm. Yeah.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Anne says, when Damien talks, every word is meaningful, that he did not allow the state to stamp out his soul as a testament to his resilience and grace and Lori's love and support. Three young boys had their future ripped from them, but the tragedy continues with the state-sanctioned attempts to snuff out the future and freedom of three more men. On a side note, I was lucky enough to visit Reading Prison when it was briefly open to the public after closing. Famously, Oscar Wilde was imprisoned there. Even empty, Anne says, I was struck by how it seemed entirely designed to snuff out hope and potential. It's a wildly vast question. But do Bob and the team have any thoughts about how the prison system could better nurture and utilize the skills and creativity of the incarcerated?
I mean, the big thing is that if our prison system had a focus on rehabilitation instead of retribution, I think that would be where it would start. And in the privatization of our prisons takes us even more steps away from that. That's the only way. Like, you have to look at, like, some other countries do, where the purpose of people being in prison is to try to rehabilitate them into, because then you start looking at, well, how we've taken their freedom, but how can we still let them, give them opportunities to grow as a person while they're in here? So when they come out, now, you know, we're talking about life sentences and death penalty cases, but there's so many other, you know, where maybe they're going to serve 10 years in prison. If we looked and had a focus of, okay, in 10 years, this person's going back into society. Our job is to make them a better person when they get released into society in 10 years. Then I think if you had that mindset to begin with, then I think then you start looking for, what are the avenues? What are the opportunities? What can we do to make that happen? So I think it's just like this, it's this whole, I always talk about when I do like behavioral analysis, even when I taught management classes before, you know, when you have like a behavior that's happened. I've talked about this before with Dr. Shiloh and Dr. Scott were on the show, where it's like, you start with, you know, when we teach people in management courses, like, how do you handle a personnel issue? It's like, well, you have some sort of consequence that brought this to your attention. So that consequence came from an action. So what was the action? But then, and then a lot of people will correct the action and it never corrects the problem, because that action came from a thought. Every action, there was a thought that happened before the action. So if we can move back to the thought, and the more forward-thinking people will actually try to think, what was this person thinking? And if we can address that, but there's even one step before that, which is the core beliefs of that person. Like, if we can try to figure out, like, what's going on with this person? What is their core belief that's leading to these thoughts, that are leading to these actions, that are leading to these consequences? And if we can try to address that, then we can fix a whole slew of problems, right? So it's that same concept, I think, for the prison system, is if we can get all the way back to this core belief of, they're here to punish them, as opposed to, they're here for us to rehabilitate them. Their freedom being taken is the punishment. Your job is to rehabilitate them. And that's why, one of the reasons why I'm not a proponent at all, as I'm sure probably almost everyone listening to this, of the privatization of the prisons, for so many reasons you can name, but the big one is, if it was a government, if prisons were run by the government, and then we can, then you have like a point of attack. Then we can go to the government that is, you know, the government, the legislators in the state of Arkansas that are in charge of how all the prisons in Arkansas are operated, and you can make your case and convince those lawmakers to make a change, then it can be implemented. But when you have, you know, different corporation, for-profit corporations that are running all these prisons, it just becomes a jumbled up mess, and you can't, it's just a very hard error to correct.
Well, also, isn't it like you should be a little bit worried about a capitalist company that actually profits from more people being in their prisons?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's what I meant tricky. By there's a whole lot of other issues besides that. Yeah. But like that,
like,
core
one. So we're incentivized to put people in prison. Cool.
Mm-hmm. So there's a million reasons we can go on about it all day, but that's one of the, to address like this particular question. Like, I think that's, if you could, you know, deprivatize the prisons and then try to push for a mindset shift in what the purpose of the prison is, mm-hmm. it would have to start there. And that's a big task to tackle.
People get overwhelmed by it. And I think it's easier. I get it, but, you know, it's just sometimes it's easier to just go, oh, they're different from me. They're animals. They're like, I don't have to think about it. If I just know you're over there, then you're, you know.
And that's the problem too, right? And I'm not even saying that's like a bad, like I'm not like knocking anybody for having this, but there's always, and this is true of anything, right? There's like my idealistic view on a thing. And then there's, well, what if it's me? Right. You know, so like say the death penalty, for example, like I don't believe in the death penalty. I don't believe in state-sponsored murder. You never want, you know, there's a chance somebody will be put to death and they're innocent. It's wrong. It's wrong. It's wrong. And then somebody, you know, sexually assaults and murders your child. And you're like, fuck you, kill him, put him to death. You know what I mean? So that there's some of that too, where these people can have this idealistic view of it. But then it's like, well, this person did something wrong to me and I want them punished. I don't care if their life is good, which is, and again, I'm not saying that in a disparaging way. It's just reality. Like that's just how humans work.
Sure.
And that creates more problem too.
Yeah. Natasha, just, this is the last comment. Just wanted to say, I think how many people felt, how heartwarming it was to hear Damien and Lori's feelings towards Bob and Jillian, how much they love and trust you, and that he wouldn't talk to just anyone. Totally understandable about after all he's been through, which you mentioned as well. Yeah, I mean, it's lovely to hear about that kind of community and that sort of chosen family thing, right? Where you see that you end up finding people that you can lean on, that you depend on, that you love. And you kind of never know when those people are going to come into your life. And we should all be so lucky to have, you know, people who show up for us time and again in that way. It's that was very, very heartening, despite everything that's going on, or maybe because of everything that's going on. It's just lovely to hear that kind of thing, because it makes you think about the people like that in your life or how you can be like that for someone else.
Yeah. And like I said before, it means a lot to me. And I don't know, that could be the last interview you ever see with Damien Echols, because I haven't asked him, but I suspect that if this testing goes through and the testing unequivocally proves their innocence and finds out who killed those boys and they go to prison, I would be shocked if Damien has any interest at all in going on a podcast or TV mm-hmm. or anything to talk about it. I think he's finally his years of misery will be over, and he's going to just go to Japan and go to that dojo and meet that grandmaster or whatever it was that he wanted to do. I think that's why, you know, Damien is one of the, you know, Ed and Jesse and a lot of the, in the early days. And Damien is one of those people where, you know, I've talked about this before, that I try to keep that kind of journalistic boundary between me and the people that I'm working with, so much so that I've tried to like back off it, because I get too emotionally attached and I don't ever want it to affect my reporting. And that's also why I'm very transparent about it when it happens. But Damien was just one of those people, and I never suspected it. You know, I saw Damien in, you know, the Paradise Lost series and all that, and he's this, you know, gothy guy that's, you know, this, you know, the perspective that you have of him, you know, and it was just like, he's just the subject of this investigation that I'm doing. And I went and I met him and talked to him, and it was, I don't know, I've just never, it was just shocking to me that when I met him, I'm just like, we became to the point where like, I consider him a wonderful friend. You know, we talk as much as we can about anything besides the case. And it's just, and part of that thing, what I always admire about him is I can't imagine how hard it is to go through all of this that he's been through and everybody in the world wants to, you know, talk to you about it, and for you to say that chapter of my life is over, and I have, you know, I've missed out on these years, and from here on out, I'm moving forward with building a new life. And that, to me, that's just so, it's admirable. It's amazing. Like the type of, you guys only get a taste of it if you like see him being interviewed or speak or whatever. But the amount of strength it takes, I think, to be able to do that and actively work at doing that has just always been so impressive to me. So
yeah, and he's a really yammering. Good. No, totally. And he's a great example of kind of the reminder that like we as a culture place so much value on fame, as if that's something that everyone, we assume, like, and I don't mean me, because I fortunately have had many friends who have been famous, who have been some of the most unhappy people I've ever known. But I think when you see the trolls come out, when you see people being like, oh, he just wants the attention, he's just like basking in the spotlight and stuff, it's like, well, part of that is because we have created a culture and society where we think that that matters, or that that equals some sort of happiness or success in some way. When Damien's a perfect example of someone standing there going, I didn't want this. I don't want this. I don't like that it exists. All it is about is a thing that happened to me that shouldn't have happened. And people need to shift their perspective and realize like, oh yeah, you know what? The end game is not to be famous. Like, it shouldn't be for anyone. That doesn't mean anything. Yeah. And it can be very hard and upsetting and alienating, you know?
Yeah. And I just want to share, and then we're going to wrap on this, but I want to share just one more perspective about it. Cause I don't get a lot of comments on our YouTube videos, cause I don't promote our YouTube channel much other than our live streams, but it was set to where like, I keep getting an email every time somebody comments on something. So I'm like seeing these pop into my email. So I'm seeing some of these troll comments, cause generally I try just to not read the comments, but I see people say, you know, a few people shitty comments, like, doesn't want to be famous. You're not famous. You're just a grifter trying to, you know, shit like that. Right. And I want to tell you that to tell you this. I promise you, if Damien, and I know this, if Damien said, I will interview on any podcast or any documentary or anything, it's $5,000 an interview, he would be booked every single day of the week. So think about that. And to be clear, I've never paid, Damien's never asked for a dime from me for anything. I don't pay him for anything. He's done the interviews with me because he trusts me and he wants to do them. But like, I've seen, I've witnessed like people like offering him all kinds of money to do. Like, he could be on a talk show circuit. He could do so many things if he cared about that money. So like, it's not like, I don't know. I think that's worth knowing.
Yeah.
For all you assholes that think that, they call him a grifter or whatever shitty thing that you and your miserable little life likes to call him. Like, you could not be any further from the truth. If Damien wanted that, he could be that very easy. Wouldn't you have to work at it? I mean, he gets bombarded with interview requests daily and turns every single one of them down. And many of them offer him money for it. And he doesn't want anything to do with it. He just wants to live his life. So I'm going to end that conversation with that before I get even more pissed off.
People. Wouldn't it be amazing if just every time somebody wanted to write a shitty comment, they took that energy and just did a kindness for someone else? Like,
amazing. It would be amazing. Yeah.
I'm sure that'll happen.
Last thing I want to leave you guys with is let you know what's coming up Sunday.
Yeah,
I'm excited about it, actually. So back when we were going over the Richard Allen confessions and we were going through and we were really talking a lot about the Reed technique, and I was giving you kind of my assessment of how Richard Allen was responding to the tactics they were using. A question came up from a number of people, both on the show here, in the live, and emails people have sent me saying, well, but what does it look like if someone who we know, I think you even asked it, Janet, if someone who we know is guilty
yes.
was subjected to these, and what do those reactions look like? And I thought that would be a great thing to do, because even for the people that disagree with my assessment, right? I think it would be awesome for people to see, at least like it's based in logic and reason. It could be wrong, but like it's from studying things like this and the types of reactions you're looking for. So what I've done, this is a very busy week. It's, you know, we're coming up on like graduation week and stuff at school. So I'm, you know, I got a lot of balls in the air right now. I'm juggling. So I thought, I looked it up. I'll get to my point right now. I thought of the Chris Watts case. for those aren't familiar, 2018, Colorado murdered his wife and children. That was an instance where he was interviewed. The interviews are public. The video and audio of his interviews are public, where you hear him go from denying, and then faltering all the way into a confession. And I was reviewing that, and it's a great look at what does it look like? Like, we know for a fact this person did it and he's lying, and you're seeing how he reacts. And then when I reviewed the video, I found it's literally the exact same tactics that were used in the Richard Allen case were used on Chris Watts, and the reactions are very different. So in this week's episode, I give a whole explainer about that. And then I'm not playing the whole thing. It's still long. I took an hour of his interrogation, because it's a great hour, because it goes from, it's kind of the same spot as Richard Allen going into a second police interview, the phase where they present them with the damning evidence, right? Yeah. And so, you know, we had with Richard Allen where it was just denial, that's impossible, couldn't be. And we get to hear, how does someone who is guilty react to that same situation? And then, it's the same parallels, even down to they bring a family member into the room to try to bring him over the edge. So it goes from presentation of the evidence, denial, taking, creeping over a little bit, the police offering the suggestion, just like they did Richard Allen, like, well, maybe it was, you know, for this reason, and then taking that and going with it. And so you get to see all the way that to a confession. So that's going to be this Sunday's episode. So it's for you guys. Now you've learned so much about the Reid technique and how it works from these last few episodes. You're going to get to hear it applied in a completely different situation where we know we have a guilty person. I'm excited for you to hear it. I'm excited to talk about it. And we're going to do that in next week's Friday follow-up. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye, guys.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music for Season 15 is created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kay Wood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X @truthjusticepod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.